You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of December 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
We are going to appoint Mad Dog Mattis as our Secretary of Defense.
The President-elect nominates a Defense Secretary. But apart from the nickname, what is it about James Mattis that appeals to Donald Trump? My guests Steve Bloomfield and Daniel Giacopelli will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the relegation of Donald Trump to the year's second most surprising presidential election by events in Gambia, the pending banishment of diesel-powered vehicles by four major cities, and we'll look forward to Monocle's annual Christmas market, which opens tomorrow. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Monocle's executive editor, Steve Bloomfield, and Monocle 24 producer, Daniel Giacopelli. Welcome both. Now, even by the standards of an excellent year for bookmakers who take bets on elections, the result of Gambia's presidential contest may be the biggest shock of the lot. Yahya Jammeh, the old-school blood-and-iron demagogue who has ruled the tiny West African state for 22 years, has been defeated by Adama Barrow, a property developer once employed as a security guard at Argos on Holloway Road here in London. Steve, this scale may be imprecise and imperfect, but if Brexit is 3 and Trump was a 5 out of 10, where does this score?
Okay, first of all, I'm not convinced until I see Yahya Jammeh on TV saying, "I concede and I will hand over power to my opponent," I'm not going to believe it's actually going to happen. And we've seen elections before where the, let's call him a dictator, the authoritarian leader who's had the poll because it was nominally a democracy has lost the election, but somehow has managed to win the election when it when the votes were really counted. I'm thinking Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, Mwai Kibaki in Kenya somehow managed to magic up a million extra votes when he really needed them. So until I see Jammeh step forward and say, "No, fair enough, I'm off."
You're quite correct that we have not yet seen Jammeh actually saying he concedes. Reports suggest, including from the electoral authorities in Gambia, say that that is the case. But the scale of
look, it's a huge shock.
The scale is extraordinary. Yeah. It's not just a win, it's an absolute tubbing. It's 45.5% to 36.7%.
So Jammeh has been in charge of the Gambia since, I believe, 94, came to power in a coup. And he has, you know, when you look at how he's ruled this nation, he talked about ruling for a billion years.
If Allah willed it, Allah indeed has clearly had other ideas.
And he was, you know, he was also the sort of leader who, you know, was not against against locking up his opponents, cracking down on free speech. In the day before the election, the internet was shut off. You know, this is not the sort of behaviour that a Democrat does. Also, let's face it as well, let's remember how you vote in the Gambia. It's not like you go into a polling booth and you stick an X next to the person you want. You take a marble and you put it in the box with your guy's face on it. This is not what you call the most sort of elaborate of electoral systems. So the fact that he has lost and the Electoral Commission felt comfortable saying these are the results to the, you know, degree they have is really quite amazing news.
You're quite right to say that a measure of caution should probably be exercised here. Gambia has not ever had a smooth transfer of power since it became independent in 1965. What we don't know yet is how Gambia's institutions, especially the military, are going to react to this. How potentially rickety are the next few weeks?
Potentially quite rickety. So, you know, this is a country with a very poor economy. It relies a lot on tourism. Lots of Westerners, including actually lots of Brits, go on package holidays there, spend one of those package holidays where you spend a week in a hotel. You never see anyone who isn't working for the hotel. That sort of holiday. It's a very poor country. It's also had huge health problems, which the president has exacerbated by claiming that he has come up with a cure for AIDS and actually would treat people with his so-called cure and ban them from using any normal drugs. I mean, this was not a good place to live under his rule.
Danny, there has been and will be doubtless more a certain amount of merriment at the more picturesque portions of the president-elect's CV, but it's not necessarily a bad thing to have done a proper minimum wage job at some point in your ascent to power. It does remind me of one of my very favourite London facts, which is that Ho Chi Minh used to wash the dishes at a pub in Ealing.
I knew you were going to say that, Andrew, and I came up with a list of the former jobs of world leaders around the world, one of which, the president of Turkmenistan, was the personal dentist of his predecessor. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Personal
Steve,
dentist.
Did you know that?
Brilliant.
Mm. Madagascar's former president was a DJ.
Yep. I knew that one.
Slovenia's president was a male model.
I did not know that.
We all know Berlusconi was a cruise ship singer.
But we could never be reminded of it too frequently.
Iceland's
wasn't he a vacuum cleaner salesman as well?
He had a lot of jobs.
Berlusconi.
Possibly.
The Pope was a bouncer.
Get out of it, really?
Really? You didn't know that?
The Pope
was a bouncer.
Yeah.
Where?
This Pope.
He was a nightclub bouncer, yeah. I thought everybody knew that.
Did you read this on the internet?
I swear to God. Well, I did, but I knew it already. Yeah, he was a bouncer. He had many jobs, but he came to the priesthood late in life, I think.
Clearly.
I have more. I mean, I can go on.
Give us more.
Do go on.
Well, this is a bit old, but Medvedev was a street cleaner. Stephen Harper was a mailroom assistant. What else do we have here?
Of course, Medvedev.
Here it is, Pope Francis.
Medvedev may be a street cleaner again if he steps out of line, of
hey,
course.
Where's the... that's all I have. I mean, the former president of Iceland was a flight attendant. Obama, what was Obama?
Community organizer.
And a waiter.
I've still never understood what that actually means.
Merkel used to work at a bar.
Okay.
People had real jobs.
But in general, that's a good. That is a good thing, is it not? Steve?
Trump was given $100 million.
It wasn't $100 million. I think it was a relatively modest fortune of just a million or two.
Yeah, okay. $14 million, I think it was.
Monocle 24.
Who among us can say their parents didn't give them an eight-figure sum when they were beginning their journey in life?
No, look, I think the point you're trying to make, you're reaching for there, is a good one. That, yes, it is good if a nation's leader has done an ordinary job at some stage in the past. And it's interesting, you know, you see countries like Gambia, like Somalia as well, where you had so many people who left during the country's horrible civil wars during the 90s and 2000s and ended up then going back when things got slightly better. So you've had the mayor of Mogadishu who used to work here in London. There was one warlord I remember meeting once who had worked in, I want to say he stacked shelves in an Asda in Leicester. I'm fairly sure that's right. So you do get a lot of that in smaller countries.
Of course, one of Idi Amin's wives came to London and opened a restaurant which got closed down by a health inspector.
Well, there we are.
And of course, Assad studied eye surgery at right here over in London.
Yes, didn't just study it, practiced it.
He was an eye doctor.
There we are.
Yeah, amazing. If you have
metaphors to be made,
I was going to say if you have favourites of your own, do phone in with them. But
I have a few more.
Program.
Go on.
Albania's prime minister was a painter, although might be former. This well,
actually,
might be a bit old.
Hang on, sorry, just on that, Andrew, you can tell us more about Albania's craning. Crayons fine. So he's got lots of crayons, hasn't he?
He does have a lot of crayons. I've interviewed Edi Rama on a couple of occasions. He has a large number of coloured crayons on his desk, which he doodles with compulsively. But a book of his improvised artworks has been published by some highfalutin German publishing house, the name of which presently escapes me.
Now, did that do well in Albania?
It's not the kind of country anymore where purchase of the works of the leader is compulsory.
Right, good. Okay. So in a sense, that shows the progress Albania is making if actually this book was a flop.
Indeed. I don't know that it was, but I don't know that it wasn't. But yes, the general point abides, I believe. Anyway, let us look now, as usual in recent weeks, through our fingers at the United States, where President-elect Donald Trump has named another key figure to his cabinet. It tells us something, though probably nothing good, that his pick for defense secretary may be his sanest nominee yet and is known by the nickname Mad Dog. He is General James Mattis, late of the United States Marine Corps, former commander of CENTCOM. Danny, is there a... What do we think in general about the idea, if you'll pardon the pun, of making ex-soldiers Secretary of Defense? Does this undermine the principle of civilian command?
Not necessarily. I mean, if they were just recently, I think, in the military, it might. I mean, we'll come to that a bit later.
We will come, because he was pretty recently, and this may be an issue.
It's a legal issue, in fact, and one that Trump's team surely knows about and they have to get around. But as a general point, I mean, no, it's not a good idea. I mean, that position, Secretary of Defense, was designed to have nothing to do with the rank and file of the military. It's not like a roided up Joint Chiefs of Staff role. It's supposed to be just a civilian walking off the street, obviously with a bit of knowledge and education, but I mean, it's supposed to be complete civilian control of the military. That's why, you know, we're not in a military dictatorship. Although Mad Dog, you know, Mattis, he's one of the good guys. Universally, people seem to agree, despite being a bit rough around the edges, everybody likes him.
Well, on the subject, Steve, of him being a bit rough around the edges, and he is, you don't acquire the nickname Mad Dog for nothing. He is extremely quotable. Signature quote, the first time you blow someone away is not an insignificant event. That said, there are some assholes in the world that just need to be shot. And there's plenty more where that came from. Do you get the impression that it might be that more than any actual policy ideas that he may have that appeals to Donald Trump and his supporters?
Possibly, yes. I mean, I think of a bigger worry, perhaps, is his hawkishness on Iran, which was one of the reasons, actually, that his tour as leading the US Central Command was actually cut short by the Obama administration. They believed he was too hawkish on Iran. And given what we know about what Donald Trump has said about the Iran nuclear deal, that is a cause for concern. The Iran nuclear deal, let's not forget, was not a deal between the US and Iran. It was a deal between, you know, six nations: the US, Russia, China, France, the UK, and Germany, and Iran. The US can't just tear it up, you know, as if it were their bit of paper to tear up. And I think we're going to have a situation where, if Mr. Trump is serious about trying to end it, he's going to have five other nations saying to him, "No, we don't think you should do that." Yeah, you know, many of those, three of those nations, you know, America's essentially biggest allies, Britain, France, and Germany. And then you've got Russia, you know, Trump's new best friend, Vladimir Putin, and China. I can't see how it's going to happen. But when you appoint people like Mattis, when you talk in the way he's talked about Iran, it's going to lead at some stage to some sort of conflict between America and its allies. When I say conflict, I mean obviously diplomatic conflict.
However, he also doesn't want to negate the deal. I mean, he said that, you know, I think the quote was, "absent a clear and present violation, he can't see a way that the White House could actually go back on it." So, I mean, yeah, he's hawkish. I mean, he said, you know, the deal is going to slow Iran's nuclear ambitions, but not stop it. But I don't think he's actually going to tell Trump to rip up the deal.
The thing is, though, with treaties such as this, if you're determined to find a clear and present breach of it, you can usually find one.
Yeah, well, clear and present. Yeah, I mean, you could kind of probably find little holes around it, but I don't think it's going to happen, to be honest. What's interesting, actually, is that he's going to have to deal with Flynn as the national security advisor. So you're going to have two really hard-headed guys who are very opposite of one another. I mean, Mattis is a very kind of reserved, not reserved, but he's a clear-headed kind of rational guy. It seems like Flynn is a bit of a wild card recently. So you're going to have two very strong military thinkers in the White House. Also, the NATO thing's interesting, too, because, of course, Mattis worked at NATO, and he's he thinks Trump's kind of former comments about getting out of NATO are completely bonkers.
Nut was the exact word he used.
One thing that's also interesting, though, about this appointment is that it was James Mattis who, according to, you know, as Trump said in his interview with the New York Times, it was James Mattis who said to him, no, torture's not a good idea. And apparently Donald Trump was like, oh, interesting. Oh, you make a good point. Okay, well, maybe we won't torture. So now, one thing that suggests is that Trump doesn't think about these things very deeply. It also suggests that his mind can be swayed by whoever the last person that spoke to him was. But crucially, perhaps, it also suggests that there's going to be someone within the higher echelons of the Trump administration that is going to prevent the US going down the path it went to under the Bush administration.
See, I don't know what to think about this, because on the one hand, there is now quite a pattern, in fact, among Trump's cabinet picks of picking people who have a record of disagreeing with him, which... you know, you have to say is probably on balance a good thing.
It's a good thing.
But yet there is, as you say, Steve, there's that maybe that suggestion that he just really doesn't know his own mind about anything at all. I'm reminded of that ancient Russian joke from the time of Tsar Nicholas, which held that the two most powerful men in Russia were the Tsar and whoever was the last man to talk to him.
Well, it might also just be that there are some things that he cares about and he's passionate about and that he believes strongly, and there are others that are, well, you know, let's just try and make it work. Let's just see what happens.
And also, we have to talk about the confirmation process.
Because, as you mentioned earlier,
legally not allowed
Danny,
to be.
There is an issue here.
There's an issue. So you can't serve as Secretary of Defense if you were in the military prior to 7 years from the point when you take office. And he just kind of, I mean, he retired in 2003. And then he was in working at various places after that. I mean, basically, it's not going to work out for him. So he has to get a waiver through Congress to allow him to serve.
And Trump, of course, has both houses.
Yeah, but I mean, already people have come out and said, you know, civilian control of the military is kind of something that, you know, if we let it happen this time, well, we're going to have to let it happen again. It's only happened once where a waiver was issued, and that was kind of 50 years ago, whenever it was. So it's going to be a tough slog. Even though he is liked, I think it's, you know, he obviously thinks it's going to pass. Otherwise, why would he nominate him?
Well, who can say? This is the thing that I think we're going to keep running up against with Donald Trump all, you know, for at least the next 4 years. Like, why is he doing this thing that he has done? Does even he know?
I should say he stepped down from Central Command in 2003. He served after that. So he falls short of the 7 years.
Basically, before we move on, Steve, is this a good thing?
Is anything a good thing right now?
Yes, I mean, it's a good thing.
No, look, to go back to, you know, you saying he's choosing people that disagree with him. Were he, for example, to choose Mitt Romney as Secretary of State, as amusing as that would be to remind Mitt Romney that he called Donald Trump a phony and a fraud, that would be better for the world than if he were to choose Rudy Giuliani. Yes, anyone that, you know, moderates President-elect Trump in some way, you know, is probably a good thing. But really, we're scraping the barrel, aren't we?
I'm trying to think of American citizens of whom you could say that it wouldn't be better for the world than Rudy Giuliani if they became Secretary of State. It's a short
list. No, you know what? This is the first time I'll probably ever say this, but give Trump some credit here. I mean, you know, it's easy to criticize him for everything, but Mattis is one of the good guys. I mean, it could have been far, far worse than this. So, you know... Let's give him some credit.
Let's hope we can all say that to each other 4 years from now.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Steve Bloomfield and Daniel Giacopelli. Coming up next, if you do have some weird unfulfilled desire to drive a diesel vehicle in Madrid, Mexico City, Athens or Paris, the clock is ticking.
They've reported, listened, watched, quizzed and cajoled. They've been to farms and galleries, conclaves and bars. They've reported from the high north and tropical metropolises. And you? Well, all you need to do is turn the dial, click our app or pop in your headphones and head off on an audio tour of the spikiest, juiciest, funniest moments from Monocle 24's week that was. The Curator is our one-hour show that informs, entertains and surprises with the best bits of all our magazine shows, from The Urbanist to The Menu, The Stack to The Entrepreneurs, Culture to Section D, premiering live every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time. You can also subscribe to the programme at monocle.com or on iTunes or on SoundCloud to ensure that you never miss a beat. Come on, let's catch up this weekend. Listen to The Curator.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Steve Bloomfield and Daniel Giacopelli. Now, none of Madrid, Mexico City, Paris or Athens are what you would call proverbial for the extent to which inhaling their air is good for you. But that will change slightly in 2025, the date that the mayors of those four cities have agreed for banishing diesel-powered vehicles from their streets. The declaration was issued at the C40 Mayors Summit taking place in Mexico City this week. Danny, this is a good thing, isn't it? Even if it's basically a symbolic gesture.
Yeah, it's a very good thing. Diesel's very bad for the environment, so this is a very good thing. But it remains to be seen how they're going to enforce it and its impact on, you know, things like running a business. You know, a lot of people rely on diesel vehicles to kind of ship goods in and out of the city. So I mean, there's going to be a lot of, as they say, that terrible word, disruption going on if they actually do enact this.
Steve, Georgios Kamenis, the mayor of Athens, actually wants to go further. He wants to ban all cars from the city center of Athens. Is this something we're going to see more of, do you think?
Yeah, and you see it in some cities already where they've banned cars on certain days, or they've said, you know, if you have a registration number, you know, that ends in an odd number, you can't come into the city on a Saturday.
Or indeed the congestion charge in London.
The congestion charge in London. So yes, absolutely. You know, you need to do this with at the same time as you invest in public transport and your cycling and walking infrastructure. So for example, the only reason the congestion charge really worked properly in London was that at the same time there was massive investment, particularly in the bus network and the tube network. And that meant that many people were able to give up their cars because they could still get in. If you don't have those networks and you're saying to people, you can't drive into town, but sorry, you're going to have to get three buses and it's going to take you 2.5 hours, then it's a problem. But Georgios Kamenis in Athens, he's a good guy. His heart's in the right place. He's an interesting mayor who's trying to change things around. He's tried to crack down on corruption in Athens. He is sort of out of the sort of problematic political sphere of national politics in Greece, and is on the whole seen as on the better side of angels.
We're also joined by Marcus Hippie, who is producing this program. Marcus, you were brandishing a newspaper article at me earlier about the capital city of one of your fellow Scandinavian nations. You were quite excited about this.
Exactly. Copenhagen, according to numbers from November, they had more bicycles, basically, in traffic than cars for the first time, which is quite astonishing considering what this city has been doing in recent years. And I think it's a great example.
It astonishes me, given Copenhagen's weather and cobbled streets.
But actually, it's so nice to cycle over there. I don't know how much do you cycle, Andrew. Actually, when you get into that habit, you realize it is not that bad, actually. It's quite efficient. It's quite fast in a city like Copenhagen. So I think it's definitely a direction to look into. It's interesting that my home city, Helsinki, has been looking at Copenhagen so much that it has decided to change its approach to city planning just in recent months. The city council made this very important decision of not taking, not offering cars any benefits in the long run anymore. So that means that they're going to turn some motor roads into, they call them city boulevards. So you're going to have houses next to that road. There's going to be cars driving slower, and they're going to emphasize bicycles.
Yeah, but that sounds great. But again, and I have my business hat on here, but what if you're a small business and you have a delivery of kind of like chicken and cheese and bread in the morning to kind of,
you know, need a very big bicycle.
Well, actually, I think it's interesting because that's the debate taking place in Helsinki now. Where my flat is in Helsinki, next door to that, they've had this amazing old area of red brick buildings, and people have been waiting to get cafes over there and small shops. And now National Railways are trying to bring a massive Bauhaus store over there, and there's a massive local campaign against it.
Because I remember when Oxford street in London. They were going to make it pedestrian.
Exactly, but there's always this discussion that actually...
Can we talk about Santa
We can also, these small businesses that are not huge and actually where people take public transport or walk there, they can actually be more attractive than if you have to take your American car and drive there.
That's the classic idealist view of it. I mean, if you're a small...
If
you have a small business, this is not a good thing for you.
You can sort this out in the car park.
I think we should have Midori House after hours where me and Denny just are alone in the studio.
Because finally tonight, before the clock expires on us, it is that time of year when Monocle staff anxiously draw straws to see who is going to spend the weekend dressed as a giant owl. Yes, the Monocle Christmas Market begins right here at Midori House tomorrow. Who is going to be Monochan this year?
Should I explain who Monochan is?
You should probably explain who Monochan is.
Okay, look, so...
We hate to say it's going to be you, Andrew.
No, okay.
Hell it is.
Now, as many listeners will know... Monocle has had a strong affinity with Japan from day one. And in Japan, lots of companies, tourist boards, local governments, basically any sort of organization has a mascot. It's a 7-foot essentially outfit that you get into, like you might see at a sporting occasion, a mascot. Companies have them. So a few years ago, we thought, well, why don't we have a mascot too? And so, I kid you not, we created our own mascot called Monochan. In fact, if you peruse the pages of Monocle magazine, he makes an appearance now
and then. He's on the website, probably.
He's on the website as well. You'll see him. You'll know him. And so we have a real Monochan. Now, Andrew, you have somewhat spoilt the magic by suggesting that Monochan is not a real person. There's actually someone inside. Mm. Can I just be clear? You know, it won't just be an intern. Because I think that's cruel and possibly illegal.
but it is not if you pay them.
It's never bothered us in previous years.
But it is. So there'll be during the Christmas fair tomorrow and Sunday. There will be various members of staff dressing up as Monochan. Many senior members of staff have been Monochan. It's not just the new kid.
CFO was once.
I have never. I'm too tall for that business. Instead, everyone always thinks that I'm somehow dressed up as Santa when Christmas market takes place. But that's actually not true either.
You're too tall.
Because we have the real Santa coming from Rovaniemi, Finnish Lapland.
Indeed, Marcus is right. We have the real Santa Claus.
I was hoping somebody would mention attractions beyond a member of staff dressed up as an owl. That'd get us into the papers as one of those annual sort of British tabloid crap Christmas attractions.
It's going to be great. We always get the real Santa who flies in from Rovaniemi. I've met him a couple of times in Lapland and interviewed
him. Does he fly in on a plane or an actual airborne sleigh?
First class.
He flies in on a plane because he only uses the sleigh on Christmas Eve, Andrew. You should know that. Okay. However, there will also be reindeer there.
Actual reindeer, we should stress, not members of staff dressed as reindeer.
Real reindeer. And usually at some stage on Saturday, there is an interview with the reindeer that I conduct. It's become traditional now.
It's one of the highlights of the year for me.
It's fantastic. I'll be doing the tombola tomorrow afternoon if you want to drop by. You could win some great prizes.
I'm at the welcome desk tomorrow afternoon. Sounds like a good time to come and pay a visit.
And what else do we have apart from Santa Claus, reindeer, tombola and Marcus Hippie at the welcome desk? Not that we're furiously padding the last 90 seconds here.
No. There's lots of good things. There's going to be... if you need Christmas presents, great place to come. A lot of our good friends are coming down to sell things. There's going to be a lot of national stalls as
well.
You know
what I would like to see people who speak many, many languages come here and say something to Santa, because so far, Santa knows so much about languages. I've never seen Santa go blank or not able to answer some kind of a question in some language.
That's very true. Santa does know how to say Merry Christmas in about 50 or so different languages.
Santa is amazingly well trained.
So are we calling out for listeners who have some facility with some extraordinarily obscure tongue or other to come and try their
possibly,
luck with Santa?
Possibly extinct languages. Too. I know he knows some Latin and ancient Greek, maybe Aramaic. You could test him out.
Is this what he does in those sort of like those long summer evenings on the North Pole when he's not, you know, supervising the elves?
Andrew, thank the Finnish education system.
I could throw kind of a spanner in the works and just say I always thought Santa was Turkish from Cappadocia.
Whoa, Turkish.
What? That?
Yeah, look it up, Google it.
Not right now.
Saint Nick, I believe, the Turks claim as their own.
Okay, can I just leave it right there at the end of the show?
They also claim St. George as their rival.
I think we shouldn't get into this because, I once had a conversation with the Danish ambassador to the Arctic where I mentioned I was going to Finland, to Rovaniemi, to see the real Santa Claus. And I was then had to listen to about a half hour lecture from him about how the real Santa Claus is actually Danish.
And on.
Or American.
That's all I say about that.
On that diplomatic faux pas. That
I mean, I think everyone should come here tomorrow or on Sunday.
Well, of course, everybody should. And we should, yes, it's right here kind of at Midori House, 1 Dorset Street, Marylebone, from 1100 till 5 p.m. 11 a.m. till 5 p.m., 1100 to 1700, whichever of those you prefer. That is all for this edition of Midori House. Thanks to Marco Sippi, Daniel Giacopelli, and Steve Bloomfield. Marco Sippi produced the show. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Gal Barnea. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. More music next at 1900. Marcus is back with the menu, and I'm back with more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at 1800 London time on Monday. For now, I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks for listening.